The wonderful diversity of life on Earth, the result of 4 billion years of evolution, is a reflection of a vast library of genes. Every species has its biological history encoded in its genetic blueprint. All the intricacies of form and metabolism are expressions of genes. Now, scientists have developed powerful tools to identify, isolate, and read the information contained in genes. They are unlocking secrets of our evolutionary past and our biochemical complexity. Whoever controls this information will have immense power over all life on Earth.
Genes are the green gold of the 21st century. Every bit as important to power in the next era as oil and rare metals and minerals were to the Industrial Revolution. All over the world, global companies are scouting for rare genes in microorganisms, plants, animals, and the human population that may be of some value commercially in agriculture, in energy, in bioremediation, in material development, in pharmacy, in medicine. And so now there's a great struggle going on around the world as to who will control the genetic resources, the rich reservoir of genetic information that took millions of years to evolve.
That was Jeremy Rifkin, who heads the Foundation for Economic Trends in Washington. He's the best-selling author of 14 books analyzing the impact of science and technology on our culture. His latest is called The Biotechnology Century. The search for resources doesn't end with plants and other organisms. Now we're prospecting for gold inside ourselves. The Human Genome Project has been called the Holy Grail of molecular biology. Scientists from many countries have embarked on a massive undertaking to map all of the genes that make up the blueprint of our species. This is more than a scientific breakthrough. Now we've decided these discoveries can be privately owned. Welcome to a world in which all of life is for sale. Jeremy Rifkin.
The United States and other governments are now mapping the entire human genome. They're locating every single gene that makes up the human species. And by the year 2003, we will have a map of the approximately 100,000 genes that make up the human genome of our species. Already, corporations are seeking patents on every one of these human genes as they're isolated. And within a handful of years, a handful of companies will literally control the genetic blueprint of our species. They will have claimed all 100,000 genes as their private property in the marketplace, meaning that any human being that needs access to those genes for medical purposes, for screening purposes, for therapeutic purposes, will have to pay for that right, because the genes of the human species will be controlled as intellectual property, as patents, by a handful of global companies.
Patenting life? Patenting human genes? How did this happen? It's due almost entirely to a judicial decision in the United States almost 20 years ago. Jeremy Rifkin was in the courtroom.
In 1980, the United States Supreme Court, by a ruling of 5-4, said that General Electric could claim a microorganism that they had created in the laboratory as a patented invention. That set the precedent for companies all over the world beginning to control the entire genetic commons in the 21st century. 7 years later, in 1987, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office issued a chilling policy statement in which they said any organism on this planet, any gene, any cell line, any organ, any tissue is potentially patentable as a human invention. Here, in one regulatory stroke, the U.S. Patent Office reduced the entire living kingdom, the genetic commons, the inheritance of all of life, to the possibility of private property owned and controlled by a handful of multinational corporations.
This is not some science fiction scenario. It's already happening. The DNA sequences of all 70,000 inhabitants of Iceland have been sold to a private company. Genetically modified sheep and fish, insects and plants have also been patented. And biotech companies can isolate a gene and claim ownership of it. Well, what's wrong with that? Jeremy Rifkin.
I think it's outrageous for companies to say that just because they discover a gene, it's their invention. That's comparable to saying in the last century, if you discovered an element in the periodic table, that's an invention. Obviously, we would find it rather amusing if someone said, well, I discovered aluminum or oxygen or helium. I isolated it. I had to use my ingenuity to find a process to describe it. Therefore, I should be able to claim it as an invention for 20 years. We would say to chemists, that's absurd. Yet the analogy is exact. Now we have corporations claiming genes as inventions simply by discovering them. In what way is the breast cancer gene a human invention? Or for that matter, a genetically engineered pig, or the onco mouse, or the thousands of genes that are now being claimed in the human genome as private property. This is absurd, and it stretches both the legal credibility and the human imagination to believe that the building blocks of life are suddenly human inventions.
A whole new industry has grown up around gene engineering. It's called biotechnology. The biotech industry has good reasons for wanting to patent life. They splice genes together to make new organisms. They can patent these organisms to make new products from them. One of the biggest areas of development is pharmaceuticals. Dick Godown is a Washington lawyer and former vice president of BIO, the Biotechnology Industry Organization. It represents more than 700 companies worldwide.
Patents are the lifeblood of biotechnology. Why? Because they are, in a very real sense, property. They demonstrate what is yours and not someone else's, and therefore they allow you to attract the venture capital and to attract a stockholder so that you have the investment, so that you can complete the work and bring the product to the patients. From laboratory to bedside now takes an average of between 7 and 12 years, and the cost is $500 million. That's why patents are important.
From a commercial standpoint, patents enable a company to recover its investment and make a profit. Patents, it is believed, provide an incentive to creative activity. Dick Godown.
A patent, I dare say, I think is one of the best social compacts that we've ever arrived at. In exchange for the exclusive right to use, produce, practice your invention for a period of years, and it has been 17 in the United States and now it's changed to 20. In exchange for that exclusive right, the inventor has to spread his invention on the public record for all others with an interest to be able to share his intellectual perspicacity, his advance, his spark, that magic that he's brought. And it has been a compact which has benefited mankind more than anything else that I can think of.
In terms of sheer output, Craig Venter is one of the most productive biotechnologists in the world. He has developed new technologies that have accelerated the rate of decoding the genes for the Human Genome Project. He now runs his own genetic company, the Institute for Genomic Research in Maryland. His name appeared on the first application to patent human DNA. Craig Venter.
Patents are very important in terms of developing new drugs. The genes for insulin were patented by Genentech and Eli Lilly, and that's why human insulin is now available as a drug around the world to treat diabetes. So millions of your listeners have human insulin to use as a drug because somebody patented the gene for insulin so it could be commercially produced. But the only reason it's available commercially as a drug is because a pharmaceutical company got a patent on the process to produce it and make it. And, you know, if it wasn't for the intellectual property protection, there would be no human insulin now available as a drug. I mean, it's as simple as that. If people don't like gene patenting, you know, they can send their drugs back to the pharmacy.
Most people in the developed world can pay for expensive drugs like insulin. Diabetes is a common disease in the industrialized world, tied to diets high in sugar and a lack of exercise. But the diseases that destroy young lives by the millions like schistosomiasis and dysentery, are largely abandoned by science. Their victims are poor, so there's little money to be made in finding a cure. Phil Barriano teaches engineering at the University of Washington. He helped found the Council for Responsible Genetics. Over the last 15 years, he's become an expert on the workings of this new industry. Why are biotech companies concentrating on first-world problems like diabetes and infertility?
Who sits around and determines in the corporations the design criteria for what form of genetic engineering we're going to have? It's the money boys. It's follow the money. It's the guys who are dealing with the bottom line. The projects that are likely to make them the most money, given how they're positioned in the market, are the projects that are going to be developed, not the projects that correspond to some authentic ordering of human needs. Where have they gone out and polled the citizens of the world as to what their needs are that can be met by genetic engineering? They, of course, don't do that because that's not their purpose.
Not only do private companies decide what areas will be most profitable, they step in and take advantage of all the work done in universities and government agencies with public funds. With the advent of patenting, the companies can demand the profits without investing in all the research. Phil Barriano.
I want to step back a bit and state clearly that this technology of modern genetic engineering was largely created with public funds, with taxpayer funds. The basic underlying science was created with public funds, and I think that as well as the fact that the purported benefits are for the public, and of course the risks are going to be borne by the public, I think that the public ought to be much more involved in making these decisions. Why do we leave these kinds of decisions up to private entities? Why do we say that they ought to be able to do whatever they want to do? We have to remind ourselves that many important biomedical developments were not patented, like the Salk vaccine. The March of Dimes and Salk were both against patenting, felt it was completely inappropriate for something that was developed with public funds and that was in such public demand.
For thousands of years, the people of India revered a beautiful evergreen called the neem tree. They used its oils for insect repellent. They cooked its leaves to make medicines. They even used its twigs for toothbrushes. It belonged to everybody and was part of the whole culture. Not anymore. Biotechnology companies have genetically modified the neem and then patented oils and other components extracted from them. What was once free and available to everyone has become private property that has to be paid for. Genetic engineering provides a way for companies to claim rights over naturally occurring organisms. They fiddle with one gene, say they've invented something new, and patent it. Patents are a way of saying, "This is mine." They give exclusive legal control over what you may know, discover, or invent. This is called intellectual property. Chi-Yok Ling is a lawyer with the Third World Network, an organization fighting for the environment and human rights. She keeps track of how biotech affects the lives of the people in developing countries.
These companies are claiming that they have invented something. But if you look at agriculture, for example, the material within which they start their work do not come from thin air. They come from the fields, they come from international seed collections, which have been donated mostly by farmers and countries in the developing world. And what you do in genetic engineering is that little bit of genetic manipulation, which technically says that they have changed something, but it ignores the entire history of the cultivation, the nurturing, the breeding that has been done by generations of farmers. And so this last bit that the private company does with this new technology is the basis for them to claim ownership over an entire history of a seed, which also has tremendous social and community ownership in the broader sense of the word.
The idea that life can be patented has now gone global. In 1995, the World Trade Organization passed sweeping new rules which have changed lives around the world. Under these rules, countries can't stop anyone from patenting living organisms within their territories. Chi Yok Ling.
Until then, countries would have a national choice. So whether I protect a patent in my country, I would have to balance national policy, public interest, and the corporate interest, and then I'll pass national laws accordingly. So in many countries, like in India, they would exempt pharmaceutical products from patent protection because they felt for national health interest, public interest, we should make drugs cheaply available. Or food products, because of food security, we would not want to have patent laws that protect, you know, one company sees. But that has all changed because under the intellectual property rights at the international level, which all the countries have signed on to, we are obliged now to change our national laws.
Most of the world's genetic resources are in the southern hemisphere. That's where the bulk of the world's biodiversity exists. But most of the biotech companies are in the industrialized nations of the north. This is why people in the third world sometimes call the patenting of life biopiracy. Vandana Shiva is a physicist. She's an expert on food issues in the third world. She says biopiracy is nothing more than a modern version of the old colonial regimes.
In the 1920s, the British put a tax on salt making, as a way of financing their armies. And Gandhi went out and said, no, this has been given freely to us by nature. We make it with our intelligence, we need it for our survival, and we will not pay you the taxes you want because you have not created the salt, you have not made the salt, and we need it for survival. In a way, patents are, you know, 5,000-fold worse than the salt taxes of the British regime at that time. And it is like patenting air because, after all, it's the biodiversity and life forms that make our life possible. It's as vital to life as air itself. It's a condition of our life process. And when our life process and elements of our life process start to get patented, it is really the ultimate of organized greed. And it's generating not just an ethical crisis, but it is really threatening to generate a crisis of survival.
In India, people are perhaps more aware of this than anywhere else. They're mobilizing to defend crops, foods, and medicines bred and shared by peasant farmers over thousands of years. Vandana Shiva runs an organization called Navanya, the National Program for Conservation of Native Seed Varieties.
In every village where we work, every farmer we work with takes a pledge that this is a legacy I have received from my ancestors, and I make a promise to myself that I will ensure that this legacy passes on to future generations, and I will protect it, I will defend it, and I will not allow it to be privatized. And through this, we are setting up these regions, which we call patent-free zones, where the people basically believe and recognize that these are laws that are so immoral and so unjust that they don't have to be obeyed. And we've had declaration ceremonies of very, very touching kinds, where local village systems, the formal systems of governance, have actually adopted resolutions and said the seeds of this village will always be common. And of course, it's so clear to people that this can't be privatized. But the more we talk about it, the more prepared we are to not let it be privatized through coercion and force.
This isn't just a third world issue. It concerns everybody. Because of biotechnology, we now have to think about things we never had to before. Who owns trees or seeds or dogs or clouds? Magellan and Columbus claimed ownership of the New World simply because they sailed up to it. Is finding a medicinal plant in a third world country and claiming ownership of it any different? That's what biotechnology companies do. In the 19th century, homesick Britons introduced rabbits to Australia. The rabbits did what rabbits do. They overran the country. By the 1950s, the Australians wanted to get rid of them. Here's what they did. They released a virulent rabbit virus called myxomatosis into the population, and the animals died in huge numbers. But within a few years, the rabbits were back. Now, biotechnology is coming to the rescue. Scientists are engineering a new and better myxomatosis to do the job. Bob Phelps is the director of Genethics, an Australian environmental group.
They're attempting to genetically engineer the myxoma virus in order to transfer a piece of the outside coat of the sperm or egg of rabbits into the virus. And the idea is that the virus would be then released to the environment, would infect the rabbits, and they would become vaccinated against their own eggs or sperm. They would become incapable of being fertilized and could not produce young. Now, there are many downsides with such a strategy, of course. Firstly, they would need to be very certain that the virus is being used would not transfer to other species. So this whole use of gene technology for so-called immunosterilization, the automatic sterilization of the organism, really is fraught with some very real perils and dangers.
We know from experience that viruses like myxomatosis have an amazing ability to recombine and mutate. We also know they are resistant to most forms of control. Bob Phelps.
I think that the world should be concerned. If a live virus for the sterilization of rabbits, for example, were released in Australia, then it's very reasonable to expect that it would go worldwide, as other viruses of rabbits have. And, of course, who would want to sterilize rabbits in Europe or other parts of the world where they're regarded as a very important part of the ecology, a very important part of commerce? And the strategy, of course, would go over to hares, which are a relative of rabbits as well. Do we really want these animals to disappear from the face of the earth because we sterilized them? I don't think so.
Who would be liable if rabbits were inadvertently exterminated by biotechnology worldwide, or any other species? Right now, no one. In our society, we assume that rights and privileges carry responsibilities. For example, we assume that businesses which produce goods are responsible for their products. So if the cars they make fall apart, they can be sued by consumers or fined by government agencies. These rules don't apply to biotechnology products today. Vandana Shiva.
Patent law is a kind of ownership law in which there's no liability, there's no responsibility, there's only rights to exclude others from the use of whatever is your patent. While the patent laws allow these companies to own living diversity and manipulated life forms as if it was their creation and of their making, there is no system to make them take the responsibility of what are the consequences of that introduction, manipulation, and release.
The buzzwords these days are free trade and global competitiveness. The lack of liability in biotechnology is a direct result of this economic globalization. Countries are forced to reduce trade barriers and open themselves to new products. For example, the chemical giant Monsanto is one of the biggest biotech companies in the world. It has developed a hormone to make beef cattle bulk up faster. The British regulatory agency suspects it's a carcinogen and wants to keep it out of Britain. But under international trade rules, they have to accept it. They've chosen not to, so they're subject to a fine, and it's not a trivial fine either. the British government must pay $200 million each and every year it refuses to allow the product in. If they did let it in, however, and it proved dangerous, the manufacturer wouldn't be liable. The regulatory agency that tried to keep the product out in the first place would be, for having allowed it in. It's bizarre. The biotech industry is totally off the hook. Chi-Yok Ling.
Now, if you look at companies claiming patent rights of ownership, and that's a privilege, but they're calling it a right. And with that right, we would say automatically, in a commonsensical way, there should be responsibilities. So what happens in the case where the product itself, when released into the environment, threatens the environment or has health consequences for the consumer? Who is going to be responsible? So in the debate around responsibility, suddenly the companies take a completely different stance. They're saying, well, we want to be recognized for our invention, to give us a patent, but if anything goes wrong, it's the importing country, it's the consumer, it's the national government, you are responsible. It's not our responsibility. And this is totally in contradiction, because you cannot in any civilized society claim rights and privileges without having obligations and responsibility.
In our society, the litmus test for safety is insurance. You can be insured for almost anything if you pay enough for the premium. If the insurance industry isn't willing to bet its money on the safety of a product or technology, it means the risks are too high or too uncertain to take the gamble. What does this mean for biotechnology? Let's say a modified virus escaped into the environment and began replicating. It wouldn't be like other forms of pollution, because it couldn't be cleaned up like an oil spill. It wouldn't degrade like nuclear waste over time. And how it would interact with other organisms is completely unpredictable. Brian Goodwin is a biologist at Schumacher College in Devon, England. He thinks a lot about the issue of biotechnology and responsibility.
The whole idea that there is a science in which you can actually manipulate things, but you cannot predict the consequences, is something that is not attractive to any technology. They want to be able to, in some sense, specify risk. Now, insurance companies will not actually sell insurance to biotech companies because they know that the results of using genetically engineered organisms cannot be predicted. There is no satisfactory risk assessment procedure. And the fact that insurance companies won't undertake this just shows you that this is a very, very unreliable technology. We simply don't know enough about this.
Jeremy Rifkin.
What happens when the first organism creates a problem? And we're talking about a problem that could be serious. So then the question is, who will absorb the liability? When one or more of these organisms, genetically engineered organisms, is placed into the environment, if it does become a pest, if it does proliferate and cause problems to ecosystems, who's liable? Local farmers that happen to be in the way? Property owners? Consumers? Or even taxpayers? These kinds of proliferations total billions and billions of dollars, extended over year after year and decade after decade. No biotech company or agrochemical company or pharmaceutical company could possibly absorb the liability here.
One of the main products of biotechnology is what the industry calls novel foods. Genes from different species are inserted into the animals and plants we eat for a variety of reasons, increasing yield or making them more resistant to pests. But no one knows what the long-term effects of consuming gene-engineered foods are. We've always assumed that regulatory bodies like the Food and Drug Administration in the United States or the Food Inspection Agency in Canada are there to ensure the safety of our food. As citizens of a democratic society, we have the right to decide what we put into our bodies. But in order to do that, we have to know what's in the food. That means it has to be labeled. Genetically engineered foodstuffs are not labeled either in the United States or in Canada. Andy Kimbrell is a lawyer who runs the International Center for Technology Assessment in Washington, D.C. He's been pressuring the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to label genetically engineered food.
Well, I think it's very, very important that people have the knowledge of what's in the food they're eating, that food be clearly labeled, and then people can make the decisions that they need to make. And certainly, if the biotechnology industry feels that its food is as safe or its food may even be better than food currently out there, well, then they certainly have the money to advertise. But the public has the right to know. Even as we speak, there are over 24 foods out there that are not labeled and that are genetically engineered, and people have no idea what they're eating.
Our health and well-being is directly related to the quality of our food. After all, when we take nourishment into our bodies, digest it, then incorporate it into our cells, food becomes us. Processed foods today bear few reminders of their original biological form. So we trust our government and the food industry to make sure it's safe. Andy Kimbrell tells a story that suggests we shouldn't be so complacent.
And perhaps one of the most shocking examples, we've recently discovered that the United States Department of Agriculture has, without telling the public, been allowing animals that have been involved in experiments making them transgenic. These are animals that have foreign genes in every one of their cells and that have been part of experiments by major researchers and corporations, have been allowing those animals into the food chain, into the slaughterhouses. These are animals with human genes. These are animals that have a variety of crippled viruses in them. They did this without consulting Congress. They did this without making this public. These animals have been in the food chain now for since 1995, and that's unacceptable. That's just plain unacceptable.
Our Canadian Food Inspection Agency doesn't require labeling of the genetically manipulated foods we're eating here in Canada. If you're eating mayonnaise, breakfast cereal, chocolate, or ice cream, if you're feeding your baby commercial baby food, you're probably eating genetically engineered foods. About 70% of processed foods contain soy or canola oil from genetically engineered crops. The multinational chemical corporation Monsanto has created and patented many of the genetically modified foods currently on the market. Russ Schneider works for Monsanto on regulatory issues. The industry says that bioengineered food products are as good as or better than the ones already on the market. So you'd think the industry would want to brag about it. I asked Russ Schneider if companies will push for labeling.
Are we going to push labeling of all biotech products? I can't say that we are. I don't know that, and I don't think we would. I don't think it is appropriate across all commodities, and for a number of reasons. It's pretty easy to label a potato. It's pretty difficult to label soybeans that may be in tofu, or may not be. And that leads to the possibility that the labels may say they may or may not be produced, and I don't know how accepting that would be to the public either. And you have to, it's a delicate balance. How do you instill the advantages while at the same time not creating a fear that shouldn't be there in the first place about a commodity? And I think that'll be the delicate balance, I think, when you look at the labels and how they go about doing it. But in 20 years, we may not even think labeling is an issue. I mean, everything may be labeled or may everyone feels comfortable, and it's a non-issue.
I have an allergy to hazelnuts, and if I eat one inadvertently, my throat immediately gets itchy and becomes constricted. That's why I check labels for their ingredients. But now, if a new genetically engineered food has hazelnut genes in it, I'll never know, because it won't be on any labels. Jeremy Rifkin.
We are beginning to see the introduction of genes from organisms that have never been part of the food chain. They're placing hamster genes into our plants and petunia genes, and we're seeing a whole range of genes being placed into our food crops and into our animals that have never been part of the food chain, never been part of the human diet. So we know that 2% of adults and 8% of children around the world have allergies to commonly known foods. We don't know what their allergenic reaction might be to eating foods that have genes from organisms that we have never consumed in all of evolution. So the possibility of millions of people around the world being subjected or exposed to allergenic reactions from genetic foods that contain genes from organisms we have never consumed is a very, very real proposition in the next few years. I think every parent needs to be forewarned.
Here in North America, genetically manipulated foods haven't been a major issue. But in Europe, people are up in arms. There's a 3-year moratorium on growing any genetically modified crops in Great Britain. France, Switzerland, Austria, and Portugal have restrictions on growing transgenic food crops. The European Union is demanding strict labeling of all gene-manipulated products. So now, North American farmers are finding that markets for their crops are drying up. Canada sold 40% of its canola crops to Europe until this year. Now that much of our canola is genetically engineered, Europe doesn't want it. Brian Goodwin is a theoretical biologist from Schumacher College in Devon, England.
There's a very strong feeling that consumers should be given their basic rights, which is to choose whether or not they're going to eat genetically modified foods. And this, it seems to me, is absolutely basic and fundamental. You would never allow a new drug to be produced without a clear label and without the company who produced it knowing exactly where it was produced, under what conditions, what batch it came from, and so on. And the genetically modified foods ought to be put in the same category as drugs because of their potential harm. They're actually even more dangerous than drugs because, after all, we eat a lot more food during the course of our lifetime than we take drugs normally. And so effects, even small effects, can accumulate over years. And therefore, people should have the right to say, I'm not going to eat genetically modified food because I have no confidence that this is going to be safe for the whole of my lifetime. Now, that's a kind of baseline, it seems to me, for consumers.
But even if we do label genetically modified foodstuffs, as we do with drugs, there is still no guarantee they will be safe for consumption. Bob Phelps of the Australian environmental group Genethics.
With the drug supply, at least, there is a very good precautionary system in place where the safety and efficacy of pharmaceuticals are checked to the nth degree in advance. There are human trials and a number of other checks. Nonetheless, we see even with those precautions that the drug supply often delivers some very disastrous side effects, killing people, maiming people, and so on. And, of course, with food, we're in a much worse position because most foodstuffs come into the food supply on the basis that they have a history of safe use. Genetically engineered foods have no such history of safe use, no human testing, and as a result, the food buying community is becoming part of the experiment. We are being used as a pool of guinea pigs in order to try out these untested and unsafe commodities.
Richard Stroman is an emeritus professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of California at Berkeley. He is a globally recognized leader in molecular biology. After an illustrious career spanning 35 years, he has a perspective on how the nature of science has changed. And believe me, from my personal experience, I can back up everything he says. He thinks that business is now driving the agenda for the study of genetics.
When we take fundamental molecular and cell biology and then go ahead out and apply it through corporate structures for use, which is a fine idea, really, the problem is that in order for the application to be profitable, which it has to be in this culture, you've got to have your eye on magic bullets. You've got to be able to boil down some very complex behavior, let's say like a human disease, or some ability for corn to produce more protein per ear, and beans to do the same thing. You've got to boil that down to a single entity that you can identify, isolate, and then put in a bottle or into a feed bag or whatever. And that's how you make money. And when it works, it's wonderful. But the trouble is that it often doesn't work. And when you put a biological entity out into the environment or into a human being, and you're not completely certain, and you can never be certain in this business, is my opinion, your ability to do damage is very high. And I think that's, by and large, what's happened. And the successes, I think, are very rare. But the hyperbola around those successes is, of course, enormous.
An endearing quality of scientists is their enthusiasm for new ideas. But this ability to be carried away with an idea was what Mary Shelley wrote about in Frankenstein. Remember, Frankenstein was the doctor, not the monster. The doctor wanted to find the secret of life and create a new and better human being, but ended up creating a monster. Today, there's too much pressure on scientists to transform their ideas and theories into a profitable product. When you demand a quick product and a quick profit, you're more likely to end up with the monster. Academic scientists have thrown in their lot with corporations because it's much more difficult to get funding for research that doesn't promise an immediate short-term benefit. Richard Stroman.
This insistence that everything be greeted with immediate usefulness is counterproductive beyond measure. We used to have a much more enlightened view. We used to give scientists money to work on problems that they were interested in. And we had some general idea, well, this sounds interesting, and you know, maybe it won't be applicable right away, but that kind of thing. But we've gone over from that to a state. Every grant now has got to be accompanied by a lay statement in which it's made clear for congressmen and legislators in general that they can go to the voters with to show them how wonderful all this is. And every country has done this now in the Western world, in any case, in the post-industrial world. It's required scientists to show that their work is going to be useful in the world. So everybody is making claims that are extraordinary. They can't possibly be met. So the grants are written that way. There's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and everybody's chasing that pot.
New technologies have always presented risks, and genetic engineering is no exception. Rush Schneider is in charge of regulatory issues at Monsanto, one of the world's largest biotechnology corporations. And he says that shouldn't stop us from going forward with biotechnology when there is a possibility it could benefit society.
We are kind of like on the frontier of a whole new adventure. I think about the potential opportunities that your children and mine have, and looking at what this technology has the possibilities of bringing to society. And I think those far outweigh the risks that we don't know exist, but may, and as we identify them, we'll have the scientific capability to deal with them. I just don't think we can afford to stop everything until we have answers to certain questions, because we don't even have an idea what those questions long-term are going to be. If we are going to stop everything we do because there might be a risk, we may not have invited fire. I don't know.
The scientist who created DDT won a Nobel Prize. It was an incredible way to kill insects, like malaria-carrying mosquitoes. But we didn't know DDT would be concentrated up the food chain until it appeared in us and mother's milk. That story alone should temper our rush to apply our ideas right away. Scientists are not stupid or evil. They believe in the benefits of what they do. But a major problem is that while we can create powerful technologies, our knowledge about the world in which they'll be let loose is so limited, we can't anticipate all of the consequences. Ricarda Steinbrecher has a PhD in molecular genetics.
It's a fascinating field, and it's beautiful, and I'd love to learn more about it. A lot of people want to learn more about it, but that doesn't mean we should produce something we do not know much about yet and put it into the open environment. If one isn't sure about something, one should not go ahead. I mean, there's many brilliant possibilities to it. I mean, of course, we are humans. We have to dream. We have to reach out and create new ways and just, yeah, be creative. But we should look in a safe manner and not sort of endanger the whole biodiversity, our food supplies, etc. And in the moment, as this technology is being used and applied, it's exactly the opposite. There is no proof, so industry says, there is no proof that it is harmful, there is no proof that there's a long-term effect, therefore, we can go ahead. I mean, if there is no proof, it means that disaster hasn't happened yet. I mean, please, I mean, I don't want it to happen. Don't misunderstand me. But we will have to get our heads around a very long-term project here, because if we play with nature in that extent, we will see the costs of what we're doing maybe then in the next generation. And what are they supposed to do with it then? They are landed with it because we couldn't get money fast enough into our pockets?
The lure of a possible new product and large profits is pretty irresistible. But patenting of life and engineering it has ramifications that go far beyond scientific papers or a stock option. Like all PhDs, Ricarda Steinbrecher had invested a lot of her life to become a practicing scientist. Nevertheless, her conscience made her give up her research in the field of genetics.
I felt there's a task to be done, and I just will have to do it for a while, because how shall I otherwise be able in a few years' time to look into the mirror and say, like, Ricarda, you knew what was happening. You knew there were huge dangers and risks ahead if we continue that road, and you didn't speak up, and you didn't try at least to prevent these things from happening. And so for the time being, I left the lab. And I think that more and more scientists are bound to speak up that something is going awfully wrong, that science is being abused. I know one in particular who just stopped her PhD and said, I've had enough. This is outrageous. This is not science. I'm supposed to find this. I'm being told that. And basically, it's a grant from the industry, and I don't want this gene to be used in that way. I'm leaving, and she did. And she's now lobbying the European Parliament. But this is happening again and again. We all have in our hands what the future is. And if we feel sincere about that we want a healthy environment, that we want a future which is worth living for our children, or for any other species for that matter, then we can do something about it, and it's never too late for that.
We are now commodifying life, and that means we can turn every plant, animal, cell, or gene into a commercial product for sale. Some say this is unjust. Others say it's morally repugnant. But the greatest danger lies in the simple fact that it goes against the biological rules that govern life on this planet. We know that all life is interdependent. When we turn living things into products for sale, we have to ignore the complex webs that bind us all together. The products of biotechnology may or may not live up to their promise, but we know for sure they will create new relationships and interconnections about which we understand nothing, and they may be horribly destructive. We need a real revolution in thought, and especially how we value life. Otherwise, biotechnology will continue to develop in the service of money instead of the service of all of us who live together on this planet.